This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Tuesday, 14th of September, 2021. Sort of a shaky session in the U.S., if you will. We managed to end the day sort of on a slightly positive note or above the prior day's close, the Friday close, where we saw that pretty steep sell-off. And we effectively have this monthly pattern more or less complete now, this idea that we're going to dip towards the third Friday of the month. Of course, that's not until this Friday, but we've sort of carried out size-wise what we've seen in the prior 4 months in a row. And you see that on slide two in the S&P 500, a pattern we warned about. I guess the remaining question is here, as we head into the end of the week and some of the key U.S. data we have out this week, whether something actually breaks and we don't just get this crazy immediate snapback rally. No ability to predict, but it just seems like it's a bit too easy for this pattern to simply repeat with this sort of almost mechanical precision every month. Overnight, we saw the Nikkei, testing basically, I think it was 31-year highs, if I'm not mistaken. There's still those highs, the crazy highs of 39,000 back in 1989. So that's going to take a while, but still the bid there. Whereas in China, we're still seeing this sort of iffy market. So what's your takeaway as we head into today's session, Peter?
Well, I think today's session is, as just correctly pointed out, we are weaker in the U.S. With the Nasdaq. I think the key, of course, event for that market is the U.S. CPI for August, which is out later today. If we get a negative surprise on that one, so basically higher inflation than expected, you could see potentially a move in the fixed income market. I'll let Thea speak about that. But then if that's the case, it could trigger more sell-off in the high duration theme baskets, including the NASDAQ 100. On slide two, you can see the months-to-date performance, all the high equity duration. So high equity duration means that if they respond more fiercely to a rising interest rate, so they decline more. And then on the flip side, The strongest theme baskets this month have been logistics, semiconductors, and commodities, the three parts of the economy or the equity market where you have the most bottlenecks and the most pricing power. And in terms of Japan, John, you're correct. I mean, we are pushing higher. Everyone, hopefully the ones that listen to our podcast know my view on Japanese equities. I think it's a overall market which is still dominated by low return on equity companies. So the relative performance to the U.S. equities, they cannot maintain. So I see this very much as a tactical rotation into Japanese equities. They just got the love from Mr. Kolanovich from J.P. Morgan yesterday. He said that investors should cut down on technology and move into EM and Japan. So there's a lot of spirit that has changed about Japan, but my spirit hasn't changed yet. I see this as tactical. And then in terms of slide three, Evergrande, we have to mention it because it's probably the biggest event brewing in China outside the technology crackdown. And it's an evolving story. I think this price chart very much speaks for itself. And there's a headline here for CNBC. Obviously, it's a very terrible situation for Evergrande. It's a very fluid and dynamic situation. Let's see where it ends. My only takeaway, because I've been asked by journalists whether I'm worried about this, and Altea, I asked you on the internal call. I don't think actually you answered the question, but to me, judging from the price action across different markets, to me, it seems this is very much an isolated risk source in China that of course could have some ramifications for Chinese credit, et cetera, but it's not something that will cause spillover effects into the rest of the world, including global equities.
Go ahead. Sorry, I'll say
it. Yeah, I completely agree, Peter. I think that it's more of a policy threat to China rather than a widespread case of leverage that is going to affect spreads across all over the world. But Peter, I think that when we look at credit spreads in the Asian market, at that point, as a big story like Evergrande definitely could have some spillover effect also to neighboring countries and neighboring spreads, but that definitely will not reach the developed worlds.
Yeah, and so far it hasn't. And just a small add-on, I just saw an article on Bloomberg this morning talking about it's gotten to the point where not an easy thing to do in China, but there are actual protests, some home buyers protesting because their homes are not being built. Some employees that bought their own company's the classic mistake of investing in your employer. The own company's wealth management products are concerned about those. And I saw another small headline that China's actually hiring advisors to unwind this, I'm sure, absolutely massive company. Well, we know it's massive company, but with absolutely crazy, I'm sure, accounting, given the size and probably some of the interlocking bits and pieces of their accounting setup. So that'll be a very interesting story to watch as they deal with this. One of these too big to fails, but it looks like they're being priced, their bonds, Evergrande's bonds anyway, at levels indicating, of course, a default and a 30 cents on the dollar on their debt. Let's switch focus, however, to commodities. And I guess really we can't really talk about much else at the moment. Well, we can actually, because we have the natural gas situation ongoing. And that's finally triggered something very interesting in a totally different space. And you've been getting some intense questions on this. And that's what the heck is going on with uranium. And we'll talk us through this, Ole.
Well, the story is that as we entered into 21 and the green transformation theme started to gather momentum, investors started to also get involved in the mining stocks of uranium producers. That led to quite a strong rally in uranium mining companies up until a few months ago. Then it plateaued because basically what happened was the underlying, what they were producing, i.e. uranium, had not joined the rally. It was still hovering around $30 a ton. Then on into the stage a month ago or so, the Sprott Physical Trust, Uranium Trust in Canada, basically starting to attracting immediately a lot of attention because they are buying the underlying stock on behalf of investors. And this fund has just seen a phenomenal growth. I put in the chart on the slide 9 here, and you can see the 1 month rally there is 82%. It just continues to squeeze higher. Yesterday and over the past few days, we've seen the Reddit army, so-called Reddit army, joining as well. The uranium squeeze hashtag is now also trending on Twitter. So it's really getting a lot of people involved. And looking at the actual mining companies, Cameco, which is one of the world's largest uranium producers, up 55% to a multi-year high. And the question is obviously, how long can this continue? Well, it can continue as long as there are still buyers who are ready to join this squeeze, because it is a very small market. So if they are removing metals from the market, the Sprott Physical Trust, then the market will continue to move higher. It is the belief, or it's on the assumption, that uranium companies will only really start to increase production if we get uranium back above $50. We're still trading in the 40s. The question is obviously, will uranium producers base their future investment projects based on a speculative squeeze in a trust, which is handling physical stuff, which can move back into the market? That obviously remains to be seen. But just to finish this off, you mentioned gas, John, and you can say that the timing of this squeeze is very opportunistically well chosen, because we have this phenomenal squeeze in Europe and elsewhere as well in gas, coal, power, and emissions, emission prices. It's driving, it really is just squeezing almost the life out of companies in Europe now with in the UK, the government is paying coal power plants to stay open in order to make sure we have the base load, because wind and sun is simply not producing what they should do at this time of year. So we're looking at a market where the belief is that the politicians will move towards more friendly approach towards nuclear, and that obviously could be the next level that we see increased demand for building nuclear reactors around the world, and that's what the market is betting on. But it's a squeeze right now. Can it continue? Yes, but it is a squeeze, so we obviously have to be a bit careful.
Yeah, he makes really important points there, especially about, because they're buying physical, that it could get released back into the market at some point, that the underlying actual demand for consumption is basically unchanged, because these are long-term projects and nuclear plants. So it's not going to be a sudden spike in actual fuel demand.
No, you don't build a reactor overnight. And Morgan Stanley, I think, they were projecting uranium to hit $50 by 2024. At this pace, obviously, we can hit it before year end. And that's potentially just a question. Has this run ahead of the actual underlying market? But then again, if the investment demand remains strong, then obviously that metal will not come back into the market.
And then let's just round out the commodity space, at least in energy, where we have, if you will, a perfect storm because of A, the storms we already had in the Gulf shutting down, the Gulf of Mexico and the U.S. shutting down a lot of production there. But now we have another storm. What's the situation here? Is that the key driver even for global grades of crude?
It is, John. And you just showed me a picture before we went into the studio of another massive whopper building just west of on the west side of Africa. It's already well formed, so we need to keep a close eye on that. But we've got Hurricane Nicholas, which is going to hit the coastline now within the next few hours, and there is again risk of flooding in its path. And already now, so far since Hurricane Ida, only 55% of oil production from the Gulf of Mexico has been reinstated. That basically means we could lose somewhere between 30 and 40 million barrels of crude oil during this period. And just keep in mind that OPEC Plus, the increase they've been doing on a monthly basis accounts to around 10, 12 million barrels increase a month. So it's basically 3 months worth of increase that we have been taking out of the market within the past 2 weeks. So that is the reason why oil is moving higher. And if we got this chain of additional storms coming in, then there's not really much emphasis on selling this market at this moment in time.
All right. Now that will take us to, what will that take us to? Let's have a look at the key data release we're all focusing on today, and that is the US CPI. And I, for perspective, put it up on slide 5, just to get a sense of what's going on with the, where we are relative to the past history of the CPI. And this is the core CPI, by the way, on this slide 5, where I show in black the month on month. And that's where the sort of the, you know, so-called team transitory got some relief with the July print at around 0.3%. I think the actual reading is 0.33%. To be more precise, a huge drop from that almost 0.8% average of the prior 3 months. So even though the year-on-year is still printing quite high at above 4%, it was that month-on-month data point. So I would encourage folks to make sure they have a close look at not just the year-on-year figures, but these month-on-month figures. We're expecting another 0.3% month for the August print today. I think we'd be surprised above that. That's a bit where the market is more interestingly challenged. And then below that, even below that as well, if we get a lower CPI print, I think that would be quite negative for the dollar. It allows the Fed to sit on their hands, et cetera. What's your take here on the CPI and the impact on the Treasury market, Althea?
Well, John, the Treasury market right now is pricing inflation to be transitory and sticks to the message of the Federal Reserve. So really, to see bond yields higher, we would need to have that CPI number exceeding expectations. But I want to take you to slide 6 and talk about U.S. Treasury yields more in detail, because we cannot ignore that, yes, if there is a surprise on the upside on the CPI number, it's bearish for bonds. But on the other side, we have extraordinary demand from foreign investors into U.S. Treasuries. And we've seen that quite clearly last week with the 10 and the 30 years auction, which drove around 70% in indirect bids. So basically what that means, to me, it means that 10 years Treasury yields could rise out of a surprise of the CPI numbers, but their rise will be limited to their monthly standard deviation, which is around 5 basis points. So they would go towards 1.4% without breaking it. And the reason for that is that to have a proper bearish bond market, we need high inflation rates paired with a less accommodative Federal Reserve. So we need that tapering announcement to gather high inflation in order to see yields going driving higher. Out of curiosity, on slide 6 on the right, I put basically two spreads over U.S. Treasuries hedge against the Japanese yen and euro. The euro. So basically what this graph tells you is that European investors gets around 90 basis points over the bonds right now to buy euro-edged U.S. treasuries, while Japanese investors gets around 100 basis points over JGBs to buy yen-hedged 10 years U.S. treasury yield.
Well, it's a very interesting perspective on the actual yield that you can get compared to these very low yielding, the very lowest yieldings areas of the world. But one place that's where we've seen the yields picking up and the anticipation of rate rises picking up is in the UK. And you point out that we have the CPI release from the UK tomorrow for August. So their equivalent of the CPI out tomorrow. And just the setup looks quite different. You look at rate expectations in the US, very range bound. But if you look at the UK, the 2 year, for example, 2 year rate sort of pinned near the highs. Do you think this this release tomorrow is going to impact gilts and the outlook there?
Well, yes, that could definitely impact monetary policies, actually, because next week we have the Bank of England meeting, and the MPC was already split previously regarding whether current economic conditions warrant a rate hike or not. So basically, what is happening here is that tomorrow economists expect the UK CPI to hit 2.9%, which is the highest figure since in basically 3 years. And that with the paired with the expectations that we might have a hawkish BOE next week, well, definitely gilt yields can rise. On slide 12, I put a graph with 10 years gilt yields. And after they quadrupled at the beginning of the year, they basically stalled and corrected during summer. Definitely, I can see these yields growing higher and rising towards 0.9% by the end of the year.
Okay, let's say, and then rounding out on the European front. So bunds, they picked up off those lows, reaching all the way down towards minus 50 basis points. I see you on slide 11, you've jotted in that minus a quarter percent as a key level. To me, that is a really key level to you know, sort of exceed that to suggest that we have yields firmly on the rise here. But I guess we're all really watching this German election, which is still about 12 days off, but as the next key sort of test for EU sovereign debt.
Absolutely. I think that the key takeaway here is that after the dovish taper of last week from the ECB basically killed the bear market in Europe until something else major happens, which is either the German elections or US yields resume to rise in the US. But for this week, we have still a lot of supply coming from countries in the euro area. Today we have Italy selling 3, 7 and 30 years BTP. Tomorrow we have Spain selling 5 and 10 years bonos. And we have also the EU looking to place some bonds this month in November and October for the Next Generation EU fund. So basically, this week we could see the yield curves slightly bear steepen, but these issuances, I expect them to be well received anyway.
All right. And now let's round out the podcast with a couple of FX stories that I want to get into before we have a look at the macro calendar. First among these, and sort of combining with the energy story, so it's quite interesting, is in Norway, where we saw the election finishing up yesterday. The three sort of center to center left parties that were expected to emerge victorious and sort of overturn the current conservative government did eke out a victory, and it was strong enough for a 5-seat majority in parliament. So this avoids them having to build either a minority government with awkward coalition from more extremist parties, from the Reds and the Greens. The Greens wanting to totally shut down the oil sector on a time scale that's quite compressed, etc. So that basically is a relief trade there for the Norwegian krona. The fact that it's a bit left is not a big obstruction to up the upside path for the Norwegian krona, given where energy prices are headed. And you can see on the chart on slide 7 of Euronaki that we're breaking down below that 1020 to 1021 area. If we can close a little bit lower here, sort of a 2-month low. And you know, if we're not seeing any major risk sentiment adjustments elsewhere to the downside, I would expect the path to be clear to a test of the really huge 10 level. And look at that 10 level in a longer term chart, if you will. Over a few years, you can see what a monumental psychological and actual chart level that is. And then rounding out the overall FX space on slide 8, we see a little bit of a rebound in the euro dollar. I don't really have a narrative to build around that, but it did find support ahead of the 61.8% retracement of that rally from the August lows. So the bulls still sort of in business here and have a local little tactical hook to, in other words, yesterday's lows to trade off of, looking for a retest, the 119 plus. I would assume something like a low US CPI would encourage the upside potential for this chart, whereas a spike in US Treasury yields would be a bit of a challenge. So let's see how the dollar, how US rates react around the CPI release today before seeing what happens in this pair. And then in the trend readings, you can see where we are. Safe haven like Swiss franc is really struggling here. Quite interesting on that front. Yen sort of tilting a bit lower, dollar as well, but nothing decisive just yet. And then a negative story out of Australia overnight for the Australian dollar. We're seeing new lows in Aussie Kiwi as we see the RBA's low sort of explicitly saying he doesn't understand why the market is trying to price for rate hikes in late 2022 and 2023, because they want to see a considerable progress in wages before changing their guidance. I suspect this is shaping up to be quite a policy mistake if the world is emerging from the pandemic, and I think Australia will be completing its vaccinations on a pretty tight schedule. This is going to fade. This is a factor. And in the meantime, you have something like the Q2 house price data out overnight showing a 16.8% year-on-year rise in house prices. Just nosebleed stuff in terms of the asset bubble that the RBA set in motion with its policy. Regardless, it's of course negative for the Aussie right now. And we're getting towards the extremes, I think, of what's possible in terms of the relative yield spread between Australia and New Zealand, but there could be a bit more price action to the downside before we find those lows, obviously. Okay, let's have a look at the macro calendar for today. That's on slide 13. The highlight of highlights is the US August CPI. There are other little bits and pieces that are interesting this morning and into the afternoon. Also that small business optimism. Curious to see that one a little bit after some soft consumer confidence readings out of the US. We have some energy related stuff, as you can see with the API tonight, etc. Chinese data up overnight. Concerns around the Chinese economy are continuing to grow. And then later in the week, we have the two other US data highlights for the week, the retail sales on Thursday and that Michigan sentiment number on Friday. For today, that's a wrap. We'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.